Good morning. I'm Lisa Stauff. I'm here for Plaintiff Appellant. May it please the Court. This is an employment law case in which plaintiff's claims were dismissed on defendant's motion for summary judgment. The district court granted summary judgment on the grounds that plaintiff offered no evidence in opposition to the motion.
Now, am I correct that the district court also decided to relinquish supplemental jurisdiction over the state law claims?
Yes, ma'am.
So those can go forward.
And they are alive and well at the Daly Center right now.
Okay.
The decision must be reversed because the district court made what this court in Logan referred to as the unfortunately common error in the application of summary judgment review, that of overlooking the movement's initial burden of production.
But I'm mystified by your argument here, because under Celotex, that was one of the revolutions of Celotex, actually. Under Celotex, it's entirely permissible for a party who does not bear the burden of proof simply to point out to the court, we believe that the plaintiff will, you know, the party with the burden of proof, ordinarily the plaintiff, is not going to be able to prove, let's say, causation, or there's no expert evidence in a medical malpractice case, so they can't prove standard of care has been breached. You know, they highlight one of the critical elements, and they say, you know, without that, the plaintiff can't go forward. You don't need evidence for that. You don't need anything. You just need to be able to point out where you think the plaintiff's flaw is going to be. It may be a risky strategy sometimes, because then the plaintiff will come back and say, oh, yes, I do have, you know, I do have evidence on this. I have affidavits. I have some documents, you know, in my own possession. I didn't even need discovery for it. You know, it was mine. But nothing like that happened. They filed their motion for summary judgment, and you did not give the court any reason to think that you had facts with which you could support your burden of proof.
Absolutely. And under Celotex and its progeny, in order to get to the point to trigger the non-movement's duty to respond, there must be a showing. Under Rule 56, the movement must show somewhere fairly.
Show means tell, you know, here. They're filing. And remember, the district judges have a lot of discretion about how flexibly on the one end or how strictly on the other end local Rule 56.1 is construed. Judge Guzman, in this instance, was apparently willing to take a fairly flexible approach to it. Whatever works for the district judges, frankly, is normally fine at this level. So I don't see how the defendants fell down in their obligation to inform the court of the basis of the motion, show what they think isn't going to happen, and then trigger your obligation to respond.
They needed to tell us what statute they were moving for summary judgment under.
Why?
Because there were six counts in the complaint at this point.
They said they were moving on all counts.
They said they were moving on all counts, but actually one was federal, five were state. There
are
no standards. Well, there are no standards for, they use a blanket summary judgment standard, but otherwise tell us no elements of law that they believe the facts as they see them relate to.
It's your burden. You're on notice that they're telling the court there isn't any evidence on any of these claims. That shifts the burden to you to show the court what evidence there is and not just rely on your pleadings, and your response relied entirely on your pleading.
And the other thing I would comment is defendants are not going to do this usually. It's a risky strategy, because if the plaintiff comes forward with any evidence at all, then the defendant's side of the ledger is empty, and the defendant is going to lose the motion. So there's a strong incentive, if there is a need for evidence to support the defendant's, the non-moving party's motion, for the non-moving party to attach it, and that's actually what we usually see. But they apparently thought in this case there wasn't, and so they put their cards on the table, and you didn't respond.
And I would argue that the threshold is very low. We can look at local rules and whatnot, and it seems like there are all these steps for a movement to take and whatnot. The threshold is very low. The case law has there are cases in here where movements have filed three-page briefs that molded, you know, lumped everything together, statements of facts with a few citations to law, and that was enough to at least put the court and the plaintiff on notice as to what they were talking about. In defendant's motion for summary judgment, we have 317 words that just talk and don't say any grounds for the motion. They don't. There's no citation to authority. There's no citation to anything, not to the record. This is, you know, the Honeywell case talks about the federal rules require a lot of people, a lot of movements and non-movements, but not clairvoyance. This is a case where clairvoyance is required in order to respond.
Well, it isn't. I mean, so our court, in a, this is I mean, one of many cases one could cite, but this is a 2006 case, Carey against Board of Trustees of Purdue, reviewing Celotex, says, and I'm quoting, the moving party may discharge its initial responsibility, that's in quotes because it's from Celotex, by simply showing, that is, pointing out to the district court that there is an absence of evidence to support the non-moving party's case. When the non-moving party would have the burden of proof at trial, the moving party is not required to support its motion with affidavits or other similar materials negating the opponent's claim. So with law, I'm just baffled by your insistence that you really didn't have to do anything to respond to a motion that looked just like that.
I think that this looked less, their motion was even less than that. There needed to be something to put us on notice as to where they thought the facts fell down. There was quite literally nothing in their motion for summary judgment that put anyone on notice. And there are certainly cases where, what they did is below what was found to be putting someone, or to not be putting someone on notice. I've cited those in our principal brief. Certainly our responses to the summary judgment went through a tremendous amount of cases at the district court level where they just needed to do something. It's not much. They failed to do that in this motion. By simply saying that we don't have the evidence, they need to say how they know we don't have the evidence.
Do they have to do that? They are throwing the ball to you. You have the burden of proof. And it seems to me before you file a complaint under a particular legal theory, you should know what the elements are that you're going to have to prove ultimately in order to prevail on that complaint. And had you come back and said, well, it's on all five of our theories, but here's our stored wire and electronic communications theory, and we can show this, 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 and this, and here's our theory about computer fraud and abuse, and we can show this, this, and this. I mean, that's what you have to do. Now, you must have known what you were going to have to prove for the theories you asserted.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise there'd be a Rule 11 issue, and I never assumed that there was one of those. So you knew, and yet you just didn't give it to the court.
It takes a tremendous amount of resources to do these motions, these responses. We need some kind of roadmap to know what we're responding to. The law says that we don't need to just throw everything at the court because somebody wrote motion for summary judgment on the top of a piece of paper, which is essentially what we would have been doing. I could have taken some wild stabs and asked for extra pages on my brief to cover it all just in case, but that's not – they need to make an initial showing. They need to make some initial showing. And this motion does not do that. I think it speaks for itself. And we stand by our decision. And I should say that in our response to the summary judgment motion before the district court, we gave the court – or the theory we ran with was, first of all, we don't have a response. This didn't trigger our summary judgment response. Maybe we could call this a 12B6 motion to dismiss. So we walked through all the ways that the pleading was adequate. And
that was a strategic mistake in unilaterally attempting to convert a summary judgment motion into a motion to dismiss.
Well, I mean, we didn't write the motion.
instead of forward. No, your response.
Yes.
Essentially construed the summary judgment motion as a motion to dismiss and repaired to the pleadings. Instead of coming forward with evidence, which is what your burden was.
We believe that the law stood behind our decision. I've cited all that in my briefs, and I'm running right down to the wire. I'd like to reserve a minute or two for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
B. Good morning. May it please the Court, Anthony Parikh on behalf of respondent and defendant in the original action, John Pigato, Frank Pigato, and TAQ Properties, LLC. We are asking the Court respectfully to affirm the granting of the motion for summary judgment entered by Judge Guzman in the court below. The Court, in the comments stated, has summarized the points of our arguments rather well. We believe that the motion for summary judgment did meet the local rule requirements and that it did state that if the Court accepted everything that the plaintiff has alleged in their remaining count regarding the Consumer Fraud and Abuse Act, that they cannot prove their case. And the reason for that was the first element under the Consumer Fraud and Abuse Act requires that the plaintiff allege sufficiently that there was an intentional accessing without authorization, or allege that there was intentionally exceeding of an unauthorized an unauthorization to access, and or that the facility through which an electronic communication service is provided was in some case, in some fashion, breached or violated under the Act.
So let me just say that I think, you know, you may have been lucky that this was resolved the way it was. Did you ever file an answer in this case?
No.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, because under Rule 8B-6, an allegation in a complaint is admitted if a responsive pleading is required and the allegation isn't denied.
Right.
And a summary judgment motion, unlike a motion under 12B-6, does not postpone the time for filing an answer, as I'm sure you know.
Correct.
So we're way beyond. Even by the time the district court was looking at this summary judgment motion, we were way beyond the time at which your answer would have been due.
Right.
So why doesn't that make all of the allegations of the complaint essentially like a verified complaint, all admitted?
Well, we argued that, in effect, to Judge Guzman, that, Judge, take the allegations of the plaintiff's amended complaint as true on their face. In fact, we incorporated their statements of facts in their amended complaint in our motion for summary judgment as true. And we argued to
Judge
Guzman.
So you were conceding that the 8B-6 effect had been triggered?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So what we argued to Judge Guzman is that if you take the allegations of the plaintiff's amended complaint in toto as true, that they still did not meet the first essential element under the Consumer Fraud and Abuse Act, because the plaintiff in their amended complaint regarding one remaining federal account, leaving the state accounts aside for a moment, alleged that he himself merged his personal email account with his work email account.
But even if he did that, why is not his allegation that you're deleting his personal medical information and family histories and so on something substantially beyond the scope of whatever authorization he had given the company?
Because under the Act, Judge, first of all, those are simply allegations, but let's take
them
as true.
Well, you said just now you took them as true,
right.
So I'm going with that.
Let's take them as true for the purposes of the argument. What we argue to Judge Guzman and we argue to this Court is that the element of the Consumer Fraud and Abuse Act, even if that is taken on its face as true, have still not been met in their first and essential point or element, namely that, as I quoted earlier, that there was an intentional accessing without authorization, that there was intentionally exceeding of the authorization.
Well, the intentional exceeding of the authorization. I'm saying I agree with you. If he merged the two accounts and put the one password on them, perhaps that's enough to show that there is authorization to go into either account.
Right.
Exceeding the authorization. I mean, he just must have been kind of naive when it comes to computers, and it seems too bad that he has to have lost all this stuff out of naivete.
Well, in effect, Judge, the deleted materials, there was literally thousands of emails were recovered from the hard drive and turned over to the plaintiff. There had to be an expert hired. Judge Guzman ordered that that be provided for, access given. All of that was done. So the issue of restoring data for the plaintiff was accomplished ultimately. That wasn't in question. And that was dealt with on their emergency motion for a TRO and an injunction. The point,
which may mean it's cured, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the theory is a bad one.
True. But again, just looking at the elements of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and looking at the allegations of fact, which we adopted in total, it still does not state a viable cause of action upon which relief can be granted. Even if we concede everything that they say in their amended complaint to be true, there still isn't enough factual support for that essential element. And Judge Guzman heard all of these arguments. He heard the petition for or motion for a TRO. He heard the arguments in the injunction hearing. He heard the arguments on our motion to dismiss their two other federal claims. So Judge was familiar in detail. Judge Guzman was familiar in detail with all of the nuances involving the legal allegations and requirements in terms of elements to be proven, as well as the factual background. And he, in his discretion, ruled that the plaintiff could not, in effect, meet his burden of proof with respect to this one remaining federal count under the Consumer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Neither side did any discovery in this case, isn't that
discovery
right?
Was provided for, but was not conducted by either side. That is correct, yes.
And the discovery period had closed.
That's correct. That's correct. We felt that there was nothing to be discovered. I mean, we knew what we needed to know to defend this case. And I would concede that filing a motion for summary judgment at that stage of litigation is perhaps unusual, unorthodox. But in these particular circumstances, we felt that it was appropriate, and Judge Guzman certainly felt that it was appropriate. And as a gatekeeper, as one who reviews the pleadings filed by the parties, he felt and agreed with us that the plaintiff simply could not, under any circumstances, prove the necessary factual information that would give support to their claim of violation of the Consumer Fraud and Abuse Act. So I respectfully agree, and the information that was provided, which we adopted as given, showed that in plaintiff's own words, they admitted that they consented to the defendants having the information that they themselves, without knowledge and consent of the defendant, Pagato or TAQ Properties, merged into the company account and information to their local area network server, if you will. So just because AT&T was the Internet access provider for both Mr. Majorski and TAQ Properties LLC did not give the authority to plaintiff Majorski to simply, without knowledge of his employer, so that he doesn't have to pay for his own email account, merge it into the work email account, which he did. And the our client, TAQ Properties, had no knowledge of that. When TAQ Properties dismissed Mr. Majorski for misconduct, they went into their local area network with the supervisor's access that they have, and they deleted all of his information because he was no longer an employee. They had no knowledge at the time that this contained also his merged, without their consent and approval, personal information of Mr. Majorski. So, you know, the judge here, I believe, and I argue to you, made the appropriate ruling under the circumstances in deciding that, in his discretion, there were no facts under these circumstances that the plaintiff could allege at all that would give support to a successful claim. Thank you.
Thank you.
A few quick points. I'm not sure how much time
you have
a but
minute.
I know it's not much. Number one, this discussion you all just had about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act never took place in its motion for summary judgment. They've never mentioned elements. They've never mentioned – I would have loved to have had this debate with them on summary judgment. It never happened. Second of all, the emails that they were referring to, they were never restored. They were all deleted. Before they were all deleted, some of them were actually printed attorney-client privilege emails and given to the police on another matter in a parking lot in the south suburbs. They disseminated some of this information. As far as discovery goes,
why didn't you put any of that in the record?
Because it all happened after the fact, after this case. In fact, it may have even been after this appeal was filed. I was getting phone calls from an attorney on another case that they had emails with my name on it to my client that they had given to someone in a parking lot.
So this is outside the record?
It is outside the record, just like everything they have put in their motion. And so, in fact, discovery, the status of discovery, is outside the record. When we talk about no discovery happening, it's not before the court. But I can't let I couldn't let that stand.
Well, either discovery did or didn't happen. That's a matter of
initial record. Disclosures were produced. We did initial disclosures to them, yes. But other than that, depositions were not taken. Interrogatories were not propounded.
No document exchanges other than that limited.
No, because both sides believed that discovery had been stayed pending the motion to dismiss. When Judge Guzman said in the hearing, ruling that discovery was closed, we went out into the hallway after the court call, looked at each other stunned, and actually had a brief conversation about doing a gentleman's agreement on some discovery. We had believed it was stayed pending this. I've expired my time. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.